two things to begin with. One, the rumor that has been passing all over the place that Black Moon came out in 1997 is wrong. It came out in July 2007. Therefore, shortlisted for these reasons. Second thing, this is the first reading I will do anywhere in the world with nothing in Black Moon or any previous book. These are all new poems. It's called Jumping Into the Deep End. Woo! I will begin with the Celtic Tiger poem, Donegal style. The lake. Seeing no one about, no boat on the lake, he breaks. Locking the car, zipping his coat, he walked down to the reeds at the water's edge. He suddenly hunkers there, wanting his glove. Scanning the lake's farther shore, the few houses, the absolute last of the jetty appear. He thought of the lakes of Italy, of Switzerland. How crowded the shores were, how many boats. A long-legged heron glided into land. A dog behind him barked itself hoarse. He saw the trees growing out of the water. He picked his spot, seeing the house's shape, the powder blue jetty, the white speedboat. He wondered how many trout were in there. He wondered how many he'd have to bribe to get the planning okay. He didn't care. Without looking, he'd find what he wanted, and he would have it. That was sure. He took his mobile out and photographed the site. Then briskly smiling, he walked back to his car. Part of the reason I'm just reading new poems is the new book's starting to come together. So this is the feel for the new book. And the title I'm thinking of running with is A Song About a Crow. Here's the title poem. I have to say something here. This poem was sparked by a Finnish picture. So the crow gets talked to in Finnish. I'm sorry. A song about a crow. The boy watched the crow peck at the ground, tugging out a worm which it swallowed, then digging around hunting for some more. He saw the grey feathers on the neck and back, the same grey as the seat of his patched pants, while the black patch on his right knee matched the black of the crow's main feathers. The boy's bare feet looked at the crow's claws. Should he go over and help it find worms? Should he run and pick it up in his hands and bring it back to the red houseboat to keep there? Tied on a string as his pet, feeding it worms, speaking Finnish to it, teaching it to trust him and fly ahead, always returning to him standing on deck, while his bearded father negotiated the lock, waiting for the water level to rise or fall, barely looking as the crow landed on the boy's shoulder with a call that earned it its throat and a song that he'd made up about a crow. I will now read two Donegal poems before coming to court. I grew up right on the Atlantic Ocean in Donegal. So whenever I go back there, I go down to the beach. I was back there last January and went down for a walk along the crypt. And then I got the shock of my life coming back down. Beach dancer. It was a wild day. The waves were charging at the shore. The sea was as white as it was blue. Where were all the surfers? I forded a rain-swollen stream, negotiated a style, then swung my legs over rusty barbed wire to go and stand on the cliff, staring out at the Atlantic. The sun that had been doing so well was invaded by a phalanx of clouds, so I decided it was time to scarper. Arriving on the beach again, I spotted ahead of me a dog playing on the sand. But as I neared, I saw it was no dog. The legs were too short, the tail too long, and it swung this, circling, dancing. It was an otter, who, noticing me, ran away, vanishing among the rocks. I waited, wanting it to come out again. I knew it lurked there, watching me. I headed on, glancing back, climbing a high rock to sneak a full look. But the sand stayed as empty as the sea, bits of which now began to follow me. My grandfather had French blood. He came in with the ear of the French onto Mayo, and he met a nice, pretty Irish woman, and the ancestor, and got lucky. And last September, when Black Moon came out, I did a reading with Cathal Sharkey in Rathmullen in Donegal at the Flight of the Arrows Festival. So this poem kind of is the opposite to the arrows going out from Donegal. This is a Spanish soldier coming back. Shipwrecked. The Spanish soldier stood on the beach at Ballyliffin. He had managed to swim ashore from the sinking ship, the last wind-blown straggler of the failed armada, and he eyed at the far end of the strand a castle, wondering what nobleman lorded it there, and whether his servant was peering at him now through a telescope. Were dogs loping their way to him across the sand? He was renowned in Burgos for his manner with hounds, and he had some English, but they spoke Irish here. Had he escaped drowning to be hacked to pieces, then devoured by a pack of Irish wolfhounds? He wished he had a box of the gold bars that had been on the ship. They would have bought him any amount of armor. He looked around for rocks to hide behind and wait. For what? There would be no rescue from Spain, nor from any of these indigenous Irish, although he was here to help them defeat the brutal Protestant English. But what help could he deliver alone? Still hadn't those at home welcomed the exiled Donegal Prince O'Donnell and named a long avenue in central Madrid after him? And hadn't they sent a whole armada to help the Irish? No one could have factored in such a huge storm. How many like him stood on a windy northern beach wondering what could be in store for them? He wished he'd done research and knew the word for hungry, if nothing else. He wished he'd done a course in Irish. He'd heard that Irish girls were the lookers of Europe. Maybe he'd get lucky and a beauty could rescue him. I read out in the festival in English recently. They didn't like it. One of them came up asking that I might be Protestant but I'm not Lutheran. Corpon, the blue. I came down the hill from Sunday's well to see a blue houseboat on the lee. I stood on the shaky bridge staring down at it and at the bluebird flag it flew, and at the woman who emerged onto a bank to fasten a washing line to a tree, then peg at least 10 pairs of blue knickers, all the time smiling, possibly at me. I sat down on the bridge, letting my legs dangle. I brushed my long hair away from my face as she disappeared back into the houseboat. For 5 full minutes, she did not reappear. I was about to get vertigo and leave when aching music seeped up to my ears, and I glimpsed her dancing in the doorway, changed into a blue thigh-length dress with a floppy blue hat on her head. I banished my yellow scarf into my bag, relieved I had chosen that morning a blue shirt, I felt reasonably sure my underpants were blue. I waved to her, but she took no notice. Then a man with a blue painted face arrived on a bicycle of fluorescent blue to jump up and grab her in an embrace. I realized I'd been ambushed by the blue. Two things here. One of my favorite words in the English language is the word twit. The longer I live, the more I feel that this world is populated entirely by twits. And I'm one. And the second thing I'll tell you is that the best red wine in Hungary comes from an area called Vilanje in the south, just north of the Serbian border. And it's a very fine red wine. It's worth making a little song and dancing around about it. The twit. The three-toed comb tends the tangle, unleashing a smile that bounced off the mirror into my eyes, inspiring me to warble a quivery, high-pitched, very silly song about a tightrope walking hairy twit traversing a ravine in a dump sea of rain. He was naked, of course, and his bare feet gripped that slippy rope like a gorilla's, while he howled German insults at the sky, thinking ahead to the huge bowl of goulash he'd devour in the company of a Vilanje red. Vilanje, oh Vilanje, Hungary's finest, he twittered as he advanced on his rope, monitored by the vulture on the mountain. Another Cork poem. The downstairs, you'll see all these photos on the wall. I wrote this poem downstairs. The photos on the wall all tell the same story. How a horse galloped past the lighthouse into the sea. It was an ex-race horse, of course, tired of stud, named Fancy Dancer, three times winner of the Gold Cup, with different jockeys all surnamed Crow. Those in the know say that horse would have won riderless, say it was lamed in the night by a rival stable, to stop it winning everything in England. I say the photos on the wall tell it all. Those races were practiced for this final gallop, this last captured splash into the sea. How the photographer knew to be there, how he had a boat ready to follow the now swimming horse is beyond me. But the photos show each stage, the head held high out of the water, the hoof frost foam, the long creature tiring, mouth opening, sinking, and finally the boy, the last photo on the wall. Fiesta. Last year I was tutoring a writing course in Spain near to the city of Alicante, and they had the great idea to take the writing students into Alicante during the crazy festival, the Fiesta. Just for the sake of seeing everything, I rented a hot air balloon, a green and yellow one with my name in red on a strip round the middle. And up, up and away I went, out at first over the forest of masts of the yachts, masts in the harbour, then in over the whole of Alicante, where crazy multicoloured sculptures and paper mache had arisen all over the city. I visited each in turn, training my binoculars on grinning skeletons, bug-eyed giants, scimitar birds, and right on top of the biggest one, a speared mermaid, all waiting for the strike of a match. Content with my preparations, I floated down to the rooftops for I opened my basket and set my pink-dyed pigeons free. The gasps rose from the crowded streets, so I landed, climbed out, bowed, asked for a beer. Ascending again, a purple scooter caught my eye as I heard strains of the Irish national anthem in the music played by the brass band. A crow flew in close to inspect me, then flapped away. A dog howled in anticipation of the cacophony. And yes, this started straight away, gunshots released in rhythm, red balls bursting all around me, then upgrading to exploding moons, till I was enveloped in smoke, making me sail off towards the sea. As soon as the air cleared, I zoomed in again over the city, inspected the sculptures once more, picking out my favorite, two huge white figures embracing, flamed by a crimson lattice. In fact, I photographed it, just as a man photographed me. I floated dreamily for an hour till the beauties came onto the balcony. One of them, the Fiesta Queen, who eventually lit the flame that gobbled the first sculpture. I watched a long gold horse with a blue mane tumbled into the inferno, while the firemen sprayed everything with water, the fire, the crowd, me. While my balloon rose in the air that threatened to bake my head into porcelain, I lifted till I thought I'd reached the moon. I veered out over the sea, making for the Balearics, choosing Mallorca to land on. Then I ordered a bottle of brandy and sat down to write this. Two poems set in the on Lake Geneva, which is the northern wine region of Switzerland, the region called L'Aud. The village I was in had a big fat vintner whose wine was very, very good. And I imagined him going up and down Lake Geneva selling these wines. I didn't do that, but I sent him this poem, so he might do it now. The vintner's boat. The vintner rowed his boat as close to the lake shore as he dared, and in the prow stood a 5-liter bottle of his Cabernet Franc barrique. A big man he powered on, past sunbathers, past sleepers, past fisherfolk whose lines he took care to avoid. Behind him a school of perch grew in numbers, as if all were reincarnated drinkers. They all shout encouraged him to launch paper aeroplanes, carrying his email address. One man swam after him, but was poked by an oar and called a wine pirate. The vintner whistled a chanson between sweeps from a hip flask, his prize-winning lead. Overhead the egg sun fried. He took a bite from a saucy song and rowed his red boat on. It's increasingly important in the world of wine how you get your wine label looking. The Village of Scarecrows. In the village of scarecrows, every house has one, and some belong to no house. Stand there meeting the cars that sometimes slow down, and no scarecrow looks like another. Some are tall, some small. One presents a smiling visage, another scowls. One is the priest, another is the policeman. A third is the village madman and guards the vintner's calves, then graces the label of his best wine, which the creator of the scarecrows drinks free every night to inspire him to new forms of scarecrow, which he tests on his two pet crows, then plants before dawn. Paul mentioned the T.S. Eliot cried. It's, I think it's the worst thing that's happened in poetry in the last 15 years, the proliferation of these silly cries. And this is to give you a little example of what it's like to be caught up in. The Eliot Prize is funded by the widow of T.S. Eliot, Valerie Eliot. The prize. Everyone knew he was the winner before the decision was announced. In front of the legend's widow, who was flirting with all the boys, queued up behind her dead husband while knocking back the port. Her husband had known his port, and he had been the biggest winner. It amazed her he had been her husband. She recalled the marriage announced in the papers by the nosy newsboys who didn't miss she was a widow. She was the most prestigious widow in the world. She sipped her port, looking at the twitchy, shortlisted boys, knowing which was the winner. She almost stepped up and announced it now, but remembered her husband. He hadn't been like that, her husband. She should remember she was his widow and wait till the verdict was announced. Where was the girl pouring the port? She liked the look of the winner. He was the best looking of the boys. Why was she still drawn to boys? She hadn't been when with her husband. Did she like the poems of the winner? Would the man who'd left her a widow and who'd introduced her to port? When would this prize be announced? A note told her it would be announced in 5 minutes. She looked at the boys and the one girl and asked for more port, wishing she could speak to her husband, but she told herself she was a widow. She found herself staring at the winner, and when it was announced, the winner praised her husband and his widow, while the other boys went for the port. Sunday morning. This poem begins and ends in Berlin, but in between it goes back to my village in Donegal, which is called Ballyliffin. The Sunday morning bells are clanging and clanking, droning and echoing. In summer, a dog, a black cocker spaniel, is howling. And my rotund grandmother wants me to go to the shop before the crowd leaves mass to buy her woodbines and silvermints and get myself a Peggy's leg. So as soon as the bells die away, Bonzo and I head up the road, for his enemy, the goose, is waiting to charge out, lunging at him, while I kick at the jabbing net and shout, calling the dog after me as the farmer stands in his door and laughs. So we cross to the other side where the shop should be, but isn't. And the dog has vanished, and the cash in my hand is a different currency. And hundreds of houses, streets, squares are all around me. So I run back down, but the sea is gone. Then the bells start up again. The last day of summer. They hung the cat at dawn on the last day of summer. They chorused out a dirge when it stopped kicking, then all together flung their bottles out into the lake. Miko held up a hand lacerated by the cat's claws as if it was a trophy. They snapped it with her mobile, allowing him alone to punch the swinging cork. What now? Bellowed Heike. It's the baby of a day. Tomorrow we disperse across this great big land. Let's have a morning to light up the winter evening. We agree, said the giant twin. Let's kill someone. A gust of laughter shook the dangling feline as an elderly jogger and a red tracksuit holds into view. I lived last year in the spring in a lovely bit of Berlin called Kreuzberg in a beautiful square called Chamisuppland. The birds of Chamisuppland. Chamiso, von Chamiso was the famous German poet of the 19th century. The birds sing at night in Chamisuppland. They sing of street bottles fought in 1945. They sing of storms that will wreck their nests, that will blow down their trees. They say, listen to the bird on the moon, the big white bird, who will fly down here when all is ruined. The houses, the restaurants, the people, when the air is too hot to breathe or fly in, when the bicycles all have been melted, the jaw bones fused to the broken street. The birds sing this at night in Chamisuppland. Say, drink water while you still have some. Go for long walks in the bucketing rain. Visit the Antarctic while it's walkable on. Spend time in Holland while it still exists. I hear them from the kitchen, the bathroom. I hear them when I'm back in my bed, and they keep me from falling asleep again. I know they will be quiet in the morning. Only at night can they sing in Chamisuppland. This is a homage to the great German writer Heinrich von Kleist, who's buried on the banks of the Wannsee in Berlin. Van. Seven horses climbed out of the Wannsee and galloped dripping to Kleist's grave. They neighed and bent their forelegs. One wrapped the stone gently with a hoof. Another came forward to lick the name. Then one by one they felt a weight drop on their backs, and a jab in the side poked them into a joyful canter along the big lake's bank. Such whinnying had not been heard for centuries, thought a man walking three barking terriers. When each horse returned, another left, till all seven had felt the rider's weight. Then they stood in a ring around the grave to neigh a soft, high-pitched chorus before pulling off in strict formation to trot in a row head high back to where they'd left the water, wade in again, watched by a crowd of shrieking kids, then swim in an arc towards the farther shore. Three poor mornings, three more we stopped. On the way to Potsdam. On the way to Potsdam, I met a fox. It was sitting in the corner of the S-Bahn carriage. I looked around to see who its owner was. Every German has at least two dogs. So it made sense for someone to diversify. No one was glancing at the fox except me. And with me, only me, the fox was appraising. Sure enough, when I got off at Potsdam, the fox immediately trotted after me. I stopped, looked back, it stopped and stared. Its eyes were brown pools of turf water. Its face was a gypsy's who played the guitar. So I walked on, knowing it would follow me, and together we reached the Palace of Sanssouci. My father died in late April 2007. April of this year, the day to the year that he died, I wrote this poem. In the garden. It's an elegy. While I was shawling the strawberries with fine green netting, you told me about the cow that swam to the island, to stand there mooing until the seagulls came in close to add their own belling, with the seagulls circling above, cow-cowing. And after you'd stared enough, you ran to the farmer who didn't believe until he saw for himself, then asked if you'd row him out there to ferry the creature home. And you wouldn't, saying it was too heavy, would sink the boat, or at least would kick out, sending all three of you overboard. No, the Narin lifeboat had to be called to bring the cow back to a cheering crowd. I stood there visualizing the whole film as you spaded the bright new potato. For my father. 1. I telephone home. The voice on the answer phone is his from the tomb. 2. I ask that he hear those last words I whispered to his comatose ear. 3. That cut on his hand as he enters the long box, is it on the man? 4. Who's cutting his hair down there in the freezing dark without any air? 5. His nails also grow. What about the blackened one on his little toe? 6. That bottle of wine I served with the Christmas goose, I'll bring it again. 7. I will roast some lamb and let it get way overdone to satisfy him. 8. If I try Irish, will he speak to me and say, I've granted his wish? 9. I want him to read these lines I've written for him if he's really dead. 10. I call his number that's saved in my mobile phone. There is no answer.